Hey, podcasters, welcome to another edition of Pickup Truck Plus, SUV Talk. I'm your host, Tim Estradol. On today's episode, we're sad to miss our special co-host for the last couple weeks. Jill Simonello is at a conference all day, so unfortunately you don't get to hear her interesting take on everything and whether she likes enough USB outlets or not. So it's all me, it's all Tim today on the podcast, and we have a great podcast for you because I've been busy. So today's podcast, we're going to talk about a big RAM recall. Then we're going to talk about two things I've been doing that are just amazing things. First of all, I went to Kasota, Minnesota to drive a tank. Yes, I drove a couple different tanks, a Sherman tank, a Russian T-54, several Chieftain battle tanks, an armored patrol personal carrier, and an FV-433 Abbott SPG, which is actually a motorized gun, but it's kind of a tank. I don't know. You make some argument over that. And I went to Grand Junction and Colorado and drove the new 2017 Chevy Colorado ZR2. Went off-roading with it, went rock crawling, and went to high-speed desert racing around a trophy truck course. You're going to hear more about that. But first, let's get to our great sponsors. This episode is brought to you by our friends at HID Extra. Go to HIDextra.com to view the best in HID and LED headlight conversion kits and accessories for your truck or SUV. While you're there, use code PPT15 to get 15% off your lighting order today. Again, PPT15. Check out the show notes for more. I'll have a logo and I'll have the link to HIDextra.com. So first, like I said, let's get to the RAM recall because it's the big news. It's a big recall, and it's kind of a weird recall. So they announced, I want to say it was on Monday. It was on May 12th, so last week, that they're recalling 2013 through 2016 RAM 1500 and 2500s, and 2014 through 2016 RAM 3500, so 1-ton trucks. The issue, and this is kind of a strange thing, the issue is there's an error code in the safety system software, not so easy to say, which may prevent the side airbag and seatbelt pretensioners from deploying in the event of a rollover. The error code can be triggered by a significant underbody impact, which can cause the module to incorrectly conclude that the sensor has failed and trigger a warning light and the instrument cluster. The safety system can reset by cycling the ignition from off, then to on run. If the warning light turns off, the system is reset. This is odd, right? So there's a module underneath the truck. And so a module is electrical module. Wires can connect together. Here's this module. And so if that gets hit, the system may think that there's underbody impact. And because of that, it will prevent the airbag and the seatbelt pretensioners from deploying in the event of a rollover. So if you roll over, I don't know, I guess there's a safety thing that you don't want the airbag to happen when you roll over. I would think maybe you want to, but okay, maybe not. So what's odd with this is why it would be located underneath the truck. I mean, I guess maybe that's where they're at, but why would it be more protected? Why? I'm thinking like a rock, like a really weird rock could go through there and jostle this module. It seems like it could be triggered pretty easily is what I'm trying to get at. The company says we're of one fatality. One person died because of this. And two injuries and two accidents potentially related to this issue. That's crazy. And as typically what happens with this kind of stuff is they'll issue the recall and then more stories will come out and it kind of builds and builds and builds. Hopefully that's not the case in this. Hopefully it's just a fix in that they would make it harder to trigger that somehow they build something underneath the cab. Anyways, it's a big recall because it's approximately 1 million trucks in the U.S., 216,000 trucks in Canada, 21,668 in Mexico, and 21,530 trucks outside of the NAFTA region. They're going to let the owners know by mail, and they're going to develop some sort of new device, I guess, to cover this so that way you don't accidentally trigger that safety system, which is just kind of bizarre that it would be underneath there. But I guess that's how things are set up. And, you know, maybe other automakers have the same thing. I'm not picking on RAM here. It's probably a design thing. But it is kind of strange that that would be located right there. And in other news, there really is not a whole lot of other news besides, yeah, the basic stuff. So new truck spotting. The Chevy Silverado 1500 interior has been spied. We have spy photography of that. It's a new generation, next generation MyLink, and the column shifter remains is the basic big news there. The Jeep pickup was spied. It really looks like a Wrangler with a bed. Jeep didn't do a whole lot with that. There's just going to be no surprise when that gets unveiled. It is a Wrangler with a bed. Beyond that, like I said, the biggest news this week was the ZR2 launch in Grand Junction and driving a tank in Kasota, Minnesota. So let's start off with the tank in Kasota right after this. Yes, folks, that's the sound of a Sherman tank, a World War II era M4A2E8 Sherman. It's called the Easy 8. It's easy to drive. It's really a fantastic looking machine, especially World War II, that we were driving at driveatank.com nearby Kasota, Minnesota. We had a gracious time with the owner, Tony Borkelum, who showed us his collection of tanks. And I'm telling you, it's a collection. We counted 9 different tanks that this guy he has bought over the years, plus tons of warehouse space that is filled with parts and transmissions. There was one rack of transmissions. There was 9 transmissions in that rack. And the reality is because parts don't come up open that often. I mean, the Army surplus holds on to them. They have an Army surplus as a sale, and he goes in and buys several because that's what he has to do. The tank drive is amazing. There's just no way around that. It's you go up there, and it's this little... it's a big Morton building off the side of Main Street. It's really bizarre. Like, you drive into Kasota, it's got a town population of 675 people. It's very southern western part of the state, like about, I want to say, 70 miles from Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. And so you drive into Main Street, you make a left as you get into Main Street. You go right past some houses, and you go, the road, paved road turns to dirt. And maybe, gosh, not even a quarter mile after the pavement, there's a building on the left. And then the building on the left has a big sign that says, drive a tank. And you pull in, and it looks like anything else. And the building is interesting. It's a shooting range with meeting areas and things. And then on the back side, that's all the adult toys. That's all the fun. It's tanks, Humvees, large army trucks, things that are big, burly, a diesel engine powered that just have a lot of fun with. So we got there, we did a safety briefing, then we went outside and got driven down to kind of a meeting area along where he has cut this trail through the backwoods. And he gives us a spiel on how to drive these. These things have 2 long sticks, and they kind of like drive like a skid steer, where you pull on one stick, you turn right, pull on another stick, you turn left. Except there's no, unlike a skid steer, you're very gentle as you pull because it's a big, heavy tank. You're not going to just, you know, fly it around. And to make harder turns and sharper turns, it's really two-handed, and it's a pull with all your might. I mean, it's grappled and all the way back and hold on to that thing to get that to move around. They're all diesel powered. Each tank was a little bit different. Like I said, we drove the Sherman, the Russian T-54. We drove over a car with the Chieftain. The Armored Patrol Personnel Carrier, the APC, was what we first drove. And then we drove, that's the second thing we drove. First, we drove the Abbott, which is it's got a long gun on it. It's like a tank-mounted gun. And that was a lot of fun because it's a smaller vehicle than the other ones. And so you can get in and it kind of gets your feet wet. So sitting in a cockpit, I mean, it's just like the movies. You got no visibility unless you put your head up and you stick your head up. And then as you drive, dust is in the air and you basically eat a lot of dust. So your choices are to see or not to see. The dust wasn't that bad because the problem is you're grinning the whole time and you're laughing the whole time, so you're sucking all the dirt. And so we drove it through the woods. Inside the cockpit, you have your gas pedal and you have your brake, and it's pretty simple. And then there's a gear shifter. It's like a lawnmower. You just push over the gear you want, hit the gas, and drive. And then you have the 2 sticks between your legs. If you pull them back both all the way and lock them, all the way back, that locks and that has the brakes and stops it, or you push forward. It's like the emergency brakes that hold it stop. Then you push forward and you kind of drive, you know, as far as right and left. So we drive around the back and we drive through the woods and we're driving through this path and you come around this corner. And Tony's got it all set up. He's got a big, almost, it's not a pond, it's like a water crossing. It's not a big pond, it's a very, very small pond, but big enough for the tank to go through. He's got hills on both sides, so you go up the hill, and you go down through the water and you come up the backside and you keep on the path. And what's really cool is that he split us up. I was there with a couple other journalists, and two journalists would drive first, and then the next set of two would drive the second time, and we would switch off in the Humvee, so you could sit outside the Humvee and watch the tank go through, and then you could experience yourself once driving and then once sitting up top in the gunner's kind of nest and watching different vantage points. It's really cool to see a tank go through water. It just, you know, just it goes down, it dips, and then it just kind of comes up, and the water just cascades off the sides of it. And then we drove that around, and then we took the all-purpose carrier around. And so the all-purpose carrier is kind of cool, where you sit like safari style in the back. So you're looking at the person across from you, and there's a bench, and so you have two benches, and then you can see the cockpit in front of you where somebody's driving, and then there's a person behind her that's kind of like the gunner kind of sighter, and then there's probably room for eight of us in the back. What's funny with this is we were there at Lynn Woodward, who's from Automobile Magazine. And when we initially did the drive with the Abbott, they told us to hit the gas through the water because the Abbott could get stuck. You need to get momentum to get through the water to get up the back other side of the hill. Well, on the APC, it's much lighter, and so you don't need to do that as nearly as much. Well, Lynn still thought, I'm going to gun it. And so she guns it. Well, the difference between the APC and the Abbott is that the APC, it's you know, and I guess all tanks are this way. I shouldn't say that that way. All tanks are this way. They're not water sealed. And so when Lynn went through, the water just came right on over her. The mud water and all the dirt right over her pants and her shirt and right over her hair. And so she got completely covered in dirt. And the wet water. And it was really funny because we're sitting back and all of a sudden she shrieks and we look up and there's water literally dripping off of her that she had gone through too fast. And so it was a good time. And so we got done with that and then we drove that around and got to experience that. And all the tanks drove about the same. I mean, you had a gas, a brake, or a gas and a clutch, and you had the gear shifting and then the brake went all the way back. I mean, it wasn't that hard to drive them once you get the hang of it. And like Borglum, he told us there, he says, you know, they run a specialized mining operation, and so to them, it's just another tracked vehicle with a diesel. I mean, it's a similar concept to all the big on-road or machines out there that build roads and do mining operations. It's the same kind of concept, and so it's really interesting to get that thought process that you're literally driving a bulldozer in many ways. It's the same idea, a really big skid steer. And so we drove that, and then we went back and had lunch, and we came back out and drove the Chieftain battle tanks. These are 60-ton battle tanks over a variety of cars. There was a Lincoln, there was a couple of Ford Escort, like wagons, and this was really amazing. So Tony set up with his team that all we had to do was get in and hit the gas. I mean, he had them all lined up perfectly, he had it all, you know, ready to go. And so from the driver's standpoint, when you hit the gas, you're just sitting there thinking about driving so much, you're not really focused on what you're doing. And so I just drove over the car, and I could hear the crunching and the glass kind of breaking and such. I didn't think anything of it, because you didn't see anything in the tank. You didn't see anything change. You just drove forward. And so I thought, well, that's kind of weird. And so we got out and did some photos. It's kind of a fun thing he has got going on there. And then the next time through, I set up in the gunner's nest and watched it. And that next time was really different because you could actually see the front end of the tank raise up a little bit as you drove over the car. You couldn't really get that sense as a driver. But as the passenger up at a different vantage point, this thing just ate over it. It's like you know, a lawnmower driving over a baby rock. I mean, you doesn't even notice it at all. And then you get outside and that car has just got a U-shape. I mean, the tank is just shattered that entire side of that car, and you can see where the track is coming up the other side where the car has got a U-shape to it. And talking with Tony about it a little bit, he said the biggest problem they have is that those tracks grab hold of the sheet metal of the front of the hood and actually can wrap that back up around the track and actually can destroy track that way, because they'll blow a drive shaft because it's trying to pull that sheet metal up through the tank. And he shared a story of somebody else who'd done it. It wasn't as experienced, and the first time through, they just went for it. And quite literally, the car was sucked up to the track and went through the track and destroyed that track of that tank. So a little bit of concerns, but he's an expert. He's done this. He had piles of graveyard of cars he's destroyed that he just buys that, you know, are probably at wholesale, And then he runs him over and flattens him, and then puts him on a trailer and sends him back and gets the metal scrap out of it. It's really a smart operation. He's a pretty bright guy. He definitely was impressive in how he thought of all the stuff through and had all the pieces together. He said, you know, as far as getting into it, his dad and him were on vacation over in Europe in 2006, and they found all these tank driving experiences over there, but they noticed nothing was in the U.S. And so with their heavy equipment backgrounds and their understanding of things and, you know, probably some good capital to spend, they imported some tanks and started getting the business. And before you know it, he's got a whole operation. And so, I mean, he's still got a lot of work to do as far as he's got to keep buying parts and keep putting a bunch of money into it. But at some point, he's going to get to that place where he's got enough things built up, enough supplies built up, that it's pretty much a turnkey operation at some point. But what's great about him is he's trying to be authentic. Like, we were there with a person who used to be a tank general, or commander, I guess would be the way to say it. And he was asking him real questions about, you know, how they would do the firing order, how they drove the tanks. And it was really, you could tell he was trying to take it all in and learning as much as he could to give his customer a really authentic experience and make sure that he was doing it right, so that all the veterans that had driven tanks in the past would be proud of the work he was doing with driveatank.com. A very cool place to go. It's like I said, you can fly to Minneapolis. Probably you can take a rent a car or something and get down there. It's not too far away. Prices range. It can be kind of expensive depending how you view it. Prices range from like $400 up to $3,000-$4,000. The Sherman is the most expensive one, and it's just old and it takes a lot of work. So he's got to raise the price to make sure he's got some profit on it to be able to buy more parts and work on it. And another thing interesting that I learned about the Sherman was that the U.S. government doesn't let you have that tank, but what he was able to do was buy it in three different parts and then he welded it back together. So he's got a lot of time invested in that tank. So if you want to drive the Sherman, it's about, I think it was like $3,500. The Sherman is the only one, as far as I can see, that you can drive in the U.S. I mean, it's one of those rare places you can drive that tank. And so if you ever wanted to be in an historic Army tank and drive the machine, help win World War II, this is your one chance. And so I would really encourage you to get out there and check it out. Check out driveatank.com. I had a great time. I put up a YouTube video. There's a story will be in Truck Trend Magazine. And here you have in the podcast, me explaining the experience. And so we'll be back with more Pickup Truck and Plus SUV talk. I'm going to talk about the Chevy Colorado ZR2. And finally, on today's podcast, I want to talk about the 2017 Chevy Colorado ZR2. I'm going to talk about it two different ways. First, I was driving around with fellow automotive journalist Sue Mead, who is a legend in our field. She actually does a lot of racing. She does a lot of work at the same outlets I do, and she's really helped me quite a bit in my career. Her and I were talking with one of the lead designers of the Colorado, and I'm going to play that clip here in a minute, and then I'm going to come back and talk to you about my driving impressions. So first, here's a clip of Sue Mead and I talking with Chevy's lead designer of the ZR2. And we're back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. As always, your host, Tim Esterdahl. We're in, well, I guess we're west of Grand Junction in the mountains. We're doing an off-road course with the new 2017 Colorado ZR2. I am with the infamous, the legendary, the amazing Sue Mead. If you don't know Sue Mead, she is a off-road racing, you're almost getting legendary status now. She writes for Four Wheeler. She has some experience in different off-road magazines and off-road driving, and she's actually helping co-produce a documentary on Rod Hall and his racing exploits. We're joined with Tyler Moffett. He is the he is a design lead. Are you the chief design lead?
Lead design lead.
Yes, he's all those terms all at once. So we're asking him today, what was the inspiration for designing the lead design of the ZR2?
The inspiration, well, it started with the ZR2 show truck, and it was to make a more aggressive, more badass version of the regular Colorado.
And I was at the concept reveal. I was at the one, because there's been two reveals. We've done the reveal, the truck, and the concept. What happened to the orange? Where's the orange?
The orange,
how did that get lost? That thing was awesome, right? We had the orange in the wheels, had the orange throughout. Like, where did that go?
I'm not sure where the orange went, to be honest with you.
That is a deeper question for later. We will dive in with the chief lead design chief person and talk about the orange. Where did that go?
So, show us some orange.
Show us some orange. Show us the orange. When you started talking like bumpers and things, was that a mocking that up? I heard some stories that you actually broke the bumper step, and that's why the change.
Yeah, when the development engineers took the initial trucks out for testing in Moab, and a lot of the departure events, the rear corner step would get crimped closed because of the lesser departure angle. So we ended up designing a plug to eliminate the step and increase departure angle.
What do you like most about the ZR2? Do you like is it the hood scoop for you? Is it the overall front end? Is it the tire in the bed? I mean, it's got a lot of cool features and design wise. What do you like?
For me, it's like the straight front view, just how much wider the track is, how much more presence the truck has, and then how much tire you see because the fascia's cut away.
Do you think it's going to be more of a like the halo version of the Colorado? Do you think consumers are really going to lust for it because of the way it looks?
I think so, yeah, and I think that hopefully the aftermarket takes it even further.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think most consumers don't always understand is you guys build the trucks, right, and you get it in the marketplace, but then you're like kids in a candy store when SEMA comes around, right? They bring your truck out,
that's
and
right,
you guys are like, oh, they did that with that?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, so have you been to SEMA? Have you seen the shows?
I have never been to SEMA, no.
Oh, so you're a newbie.
Someday I'll be able to get there.
I bet you'll be going this year because I bet this truck is going to be one of the top trucks for modifications, and you have to go. It's just an incredible show. And as Tim said, it's going to be really fun to see what off-road enthusiasts and racers and others do with the truck, kind of building on what you've done.
Yeah, for sure.
So when you mocked it up and you designed it, did you build one for yourself? Did you play around with it?
I didn't, no. We didn't have the chance to do that in design.
So
we don't get as down and dirty as some of the development engineers do, unfortunately.
So would you build it the same way you see it, or would you do something different with it?
I would build it like the truck in front of us, like the service body truck.
Oh, yes. So
that's how I would build it.
The truck in front of us has a service body rear end. It's got the bed off of it, and it's like a... It's like the rural power guy trying to go do his job. It's a whole different... This is not the milkman... Well, it maybe is the milkman apparatus if he's trying to get to a power line or to a customer way off in the boonies, but it is a spectacular-looking truck. It's a very interesting design and look to it. It's very unique. Air dam. Was that the first thing that got torn off?
That's the first thing that got torn off, yeah. Air dam and pretty much the whole lower front fascia got torn off.
Now, was that before testing, or did you have some fun testing with
it? No, that was just to make the design look off-road capable, just from the beginning before any testing happened.
Did you look back at any of the old ZR2 photos and things for, like, inspiration and design?
Yeah, I did, because I used to really, as a kid, I used to really like the original ZR2s, and so that was... Because design had a big role in even proposing that this truck existing again. It was kind of our idea for the show truck, and it spurred on the production truck, and so.
Yeah, it's definitely something that stands out more. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the current generation Colorado. I like it as well, but this is a completely different look.
Yeah.
So was there much? I'm sure there was many meetings about whether to build a truck or not. But was there any like concerns about building a truck, or was it just a let's go for it?
No, I think the show truck was the kind of the clinic, if you will, or the focus group for whether we should build a truck or not, and there wasn't any confusion after that was shown that, you know, we needed to do it. So.
So I have a question related to design. One of the things I told Tim this morning when I saw the lineup of vehicles was that there certainly are differences, and particularly the front look and the scoop and the wider track and the ground clearance. But one of the things I noticed and like about it is that it doesn't have that growly in your face look. It's got the capability that a lot of trucks that have gone with that design direction. So is that certainly it stands out from the regular Colorado, but did you also think I would like a customer to go off-road and play with it and drive hard and know it's really capable, but park it on the street, go to the grocery store, and not feel like they've got something that's screaming in someone's face.
Yeah, and we also looked, that's true, and we also looked at a lot of vehicle trends and how vehicles come from the factory, and then what do customers do after they get them. And we noticed in this realm, you know, people like gloss black and they like flat black, they don't like chrome. So we just decided, because initially we had chrome strips to kind of connect the headlamps on the front, and we made the decision just to go all black because we figured most people would do it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would get the plastic dip out and go, I don't want this chrome. Cover that stuff up.
So another question I have, when you were looking at this market and this mid-sized truck making it, again, have a lot of aftermarket capability, were you also playing with keeping it at a certain price level and making sure that what you put on was aggressive, but that it was a good factory warranty package at a reasonable price?
Yeah, for us in design, it's like depending on the project, we would want the biggest pocketbook in the world so we could get whatever we want on the car. But for this one, it was unique in that everything that was designed for the show truck going into production was functional and aesthetic. So pretty much every part that was costed for was for a reason. So there's nothing extraneous on the truck.
So what's the base package as an over, or an upcharge rather, I guess, from the Colorado to this fully set up?
Money-wise, I'm not the expert on that. I don't have any of the specs on cost.
I'm guessing about 7,000, Tim.
I would think
that.
So.
We can look into that, but
We pulled the Monroney so we're in the gasoline version right now, gasoline crew cab, which was $43,560. It had the $1,000 upgrade audio package to it. And I actually walked over and pulled the Monroney on the diesel. And the diesel next to us, I think it was the rear seat delete extended cab version, was like 45. Mm-hmm. I think it was a 45. I think you're going to get a crew cab for 47 would be my guess without grabbing the Monroney. It seems like that'd be the price point. And I believe you can get a crew cab Colorado base. I think it's in the mid to early 30s. So, I mean, you're going to add quite a bit, but I think you add quite a bit of capability as well. It's really interesting. This truck is going to be the whole argument whether you build it or buy it, right? That's the whole argument of these off-road trucks. Do you buy the base version and then build it yourself, or do you buy the already done ZR2? I think dollar-wise, when you look at all those specifics, it always works out better to buy the ZR2 than it does to do the base by the time you're doing all the suspension upgrades and stuff like that, but...
Especially the lockers. I've looked into putting lockers on my personal trucks, and to do an e-locker front and rear, you're already at the upcharge for ZR2.
Yeah,
without all the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You package these together, you get quite a deal. But I don't know about you, Sue. I didn't think 45 in the diesel. I didn't think that was that bad. We just hit a big boulder.
Yeah.
We have rock rails on this, and I'm pretty zipped.
Yeah. Legend.
I watched this
line going through, and I thought I had that cleared. But it was a nice gentle bump, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
I think the pricing is great, and I guess to go back to your point, enthusiasts have an opportunity to do their upfits themselves, and many people like to, but then they're not warrantied. And mm-hmm. I think when you buy a package that has been engineered for that particular truck and tested by its engineers and working with folks like yourself in design, that the advantage is, as you said, you can spend that amount of upcharge just on lockers, so you can get a better deal, but also you've got a warranty package, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big factor too, especially off-roading, where you're going to beat it up, you're going to try to break it, you're going to try to do things. We had a dinner last night, and they were talking about how much they were trying to beat up the Colorado, the ZR2, and how well it actually held together, which I think is a testament to the parts you design and buy and purchase and
and put together in a package. So we're gonna keep driving here, and I want to say beautiful Grand Junction, but it's kind of cloudy, cold. A lot of the Southern California boys are cold out here, but we're fine. And we'll be back with more.
They're wusses. Come on, this is beautiful.
We'll be back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk.
I hope you enjoyed the interview. Tyler and I actually spent a lot of time that day driving around. He is restoring a very interesting truck. It's a late 1970s, I'm going to say a 79 Chevy Love. You remember the little small trucks? Yeah, he has one. And instead of like just beating it up and, you know, doing the standard stuff you do with those kind of trucks these days, he's restoring it. And he's doing a lot of work as getting the truck back and running, ordering parts from Thailand and overseas because that's where they still make some of the parts. And so he's taking it back to stock, and he's doing a really great job on it. And I can't wait to see it when it's finally done. But a very interesting guy. So, and anyways, let's get back to the Chevy Colorado ZR2. This is a really fun truck for me. And I'm going to give you some backstory on this, is that when this truck came out, it was a concept in 2014 in LA Auto Show. And I was there at the show. One of the very, very few times I've gone to the LA Auto Show. That show just isn't a big... it's just not a big truck show. And so I was there at the show, and I'm seeing this thing get revealed. And at the time, there was a Chevy PR person named Odie McKinley. And Odie and I had some good banter going back and forth. And they unveiled this truck, and we literally jumped in Odie's private skin area. I mean, everybody, Truck Trend and myself and PickupTrucks.com, and everybody was right there in his face saying, "You have to build this truck. You guys need to build this truck immediately for your brand, for your customers, for everything. You have to build this truck." And so what I came to find out from Tyler through our interview was they did that, and literally the next month after the LA Auto Show, they had such feedback from the journalists and the public about the ZR2. It really stole the show. And so they went to work. They got the work right away. And so they had to take the Colorado out, the standard stock one. And what's interesting about this story that I really like about it is that a lot of people assume, and I've talked to consumers about this, who assume that Chevy can just build whatever they want. They build an off-road truck, they just build it. You know, they want to do a heavy-duty half-ton, they just build it. Well, that's not always how the case works. A lot of these companies, yes, they're big companies, lots of employees, but a lot of those employees are the assembly line workers, or they're the admin people, or the warranty people. Inside the engineering group, it's not as large as you would think. And so when they went to build the ZR2, they knew they had to make it an off-road truck, you know, a true off-road racing truck, but they didn't have a whole lot of talent. A whole lot of people that did a lot of off-roading. You know, their design and engineering facility is there in Michigan. Not Southern California, where the off-roading takes a lot of place in the desert. And so they didn't have that talent built up. And since they had lost Hummer, and Hummer had closed, a lot of the off-road and four-wheel drive guys from Hummer that would give them the talent were gone. And that's the reality of it. There's no Colin Ivan Stewart coming in to build a Chevy ZR2. He's with Toyota. I mean, these companies hoard the off-road talent they have, and they try to cultivate that because they know how important it is to have that real experience to build a quality truck. And so Chevy didn't have that. The chief engineer didn't have that, which is a bit unique. I mean, usually you take time to build it, but they were on a tight time frame. So they found two guys left over from the Hummer days that still were on staff, and so they brought those guys in, and then they went and learned off-roading. They went to Indiana to the off-road park. They went to Southern California, the off-road park. They went to the Rubicon Trail. They went to Nevada. They did a bunch of off-roading to learn, and that's fascinating because, you know, a lot of times engineers, especially, so let's talk Ford, for example. Ford's built the Raptor for years. If they want to take a Ranger, build a Raptor, they could literally just do it overnight because they have the team in place. Chevy had to learn this knowledge. And so really getting out there and doing it, I was really excited to talk to them and how much they learned and how much they were excited about off-roading. You know, they were excited about getting out there. This was a really great experience for them. And the truck shows it. I mean, they really took their time. They really beat it up. They made a lot of modifications. The front bumper is different. The rear bumper is different. They took off the steps in the rear bumper because they cracked them so many times going off-roading. They put the hood scoop on the front to give it a really cool look to it. They did a lot of things to this truck to make it look really cool. And then the inside, they have a pretty good inside already. So they just added some stitching, and they did a lot with some of the mechanicals. So they added front and rear locker because when you're doing a Rubicon Trail, especially, those things are important. And so they added front and rear lockers. They added some Baja setup and the four-wheel drive setup. And so they made this truck a much better off-road truck. And so we did some high-speed off-roading. And I got to tell you, we all caught air, every single one of us. Edmunds was there, Truck Trend was there, Car and Driver was there. And we all caught air. And what's great is when you landed, it was like landing on a pillow. The shocks. This is the big story you're going to get from this truck, is the shocks. I got to stop and slow down for a minute, because the truck looks really cool and it drives really smooth. The interior is really nice. I mean, it's got the pieces in place that without the shocks, it'd even be a decent competitor. But the shocks are what it puts over the top. So what's interesting here is typically when you do an off-road truck, most manufacturers go to the name brands. They go to the Fox, the Bilsteins. They go to the people that built shocks for years. Chevy did something completely different and really was pretty brave of them to do this. Is they went across the border to Canada. They went to Multimatic. And Multimatic makes suspension shock systems for F1 Formula 1 racing cars and the Z28, the Chevy Camaro Z28 or Chevy Corvette. It's a car. I don't know. a racing car, right? So a sports car. They built the shocks for the sports cars. And so that suspension was a road suspension. It's a pavement suspension, I should say. But they adapted it to the off-road environment. And what's interesting is they dialed this in to the point where it works so well, it makes you wonder why Fox and Bilstein don't do the same thing. I mean, these shocks are really impressive. I have a video on YouTube where I talk about with the shocks. I talk with the guy that designed the shocks. I can tell you that they're really hard to explain. It's got a remote reservoir in it. It's got little fittings that really help keep it cool. And so what the magic really is the way it's designed and the way it's set up and the cooling effect. You can take these shocks and beat them all day long and put your hand on them and they don't get that hot. It's the way that they're able to cycle through the fluids and cycle through the shocks to keep them from getting too hot. And in fact, I just decided something, and I'm going to stop this and get the recording of him talking about it, and I'll play that next.
Murray White, I'm technical director of vehicle development at Multimatic. We supply these dampers for all trucks.
Okay, so let's walk through these.
All right, well these are the dampers. That's a front shock, and that's a rear shock from the ZR2. And they operate on, the valving is controlled with our spool valve technology, which we also use in Formula 1. So that happens to be a Formula 1 damper as well. So kind of a different scale, but the same kinds of valves inside it. And the actual valving is the oil flow through the damper is controlled by these guys, which is a hydraulic spool valve rather than a shim stack in a typical shock absorber. And we have a coil spring and this shuttle, we call it, and the shaped windows. So when the oil pressure acts on the top, it moves the shuttle and exposes the window to allow oil to escape. And the shape of that window, along with the spring rate, defines the shape of the force velocity curve that the damper produces. So by changing the shape of this window, we can very precisely tailor the shape of the force velocity curve and make it pretty much do what we want. So it's a lot more tunable than a shim valve typically. So it really helps dial in the performance of the truck. So when it's also position sensitive. So there's two of these valves back to back inside this valve body here, which when the damper is operating in the normal range, the damping is controlled, one of these for compression and one for rebound inside this chamber. And when the damper reaches a certain amount of compression, the piston crosses over some holes in the inner tube, and then the compression force is controlled by a third spool valve, which is actually in the piston. So there's a total of these three of these spool valve arrangements inside the damper. In the normal kind of on-road operating range, it's using the two in the main body, one for compression, one for rebound. When it's in the PSD region, we call it position-sensitive damping region, when you get a really big hit, to absorb more energy, it picks up a lot of damping as it reaches the end of stroke, and that's controlled by the piston spool valve arrangement.
So there you have his explanation of how the shocks work. The little spool valves, and I know you can't see it because it's in the podcast, But little spool valves are probably the length of your thumb. I mean, they're not very tall. Maybe maybe an inch or two. And they're circular, so they're probably only an inch in diameter. And so they have it. They're metal, and on the inside of them, there's little bearings. And the outside is these little cut windows. And he's talking about, it looks like, imagine like a metal cup. So you have a metal cup, like a coffee cup without the handle. And you have these bearings inside, these little bearings sit inside. And the oil goes in. And then as the pressure goes in, that spring pushes down the bearings. And then imagine you cut little windows in your coffee cup. And then that way the oil can come out of that. And it can get recycled and won't be so hot. And it responds faster. And they can control the response rate of those shocks by the position of those windows and how big and how small they make them. And honestly, that's the best way I can describe it. It's really impressive stuff that challenged my understanding of shocks and challenged how I thought about them and how important I thought they were. And so it's a very interesting decision to go across the border, to go with somebody's no name. I mean, I can see fans right now saying, oh, I'm not going to use that. I'm going to go with the tried and true Fox or Bilsteins. I like those shocks better. I got to tell you what, you got to give these a shot. And you got to, I think and I hope that they'll sell these in the aftermarket, because I know for myself, I really would like to see them on more products. I think they really are shaking up the game. And this could be the one thing that comes out of Chevy Colorado, the ZR2 the most, is the shocks. They are that good. Besides that, the Colorado is a great truck to drive around. It was really nice and comfortable on-road and off-road. There's some Goodyear DuraTrack 31-inch tires to use on this truck. They have a unique tread pattern. And they're not unique tread pattern to the ZR2. But on-road, it was very smooth. Those shocks attuned really well, the Multimatic. And off-road, it was very capable. We did high speed, and we did rock crawling. We did lead and follow through some rock crawling. There was a couple stair steps, which are basically rock steps that you have to climb over. And the truck did great. It was fun to drive around. You could drive around all day in it. It was very comfortable. I will make a note that there is a big decision to make with the Chevy Colorado ZR2, is that it comes in a gasoline, a 3.6-liter V6 gasoline with an 8-speed, not manual, 8-speed transmission automatic, or you can get it in the diesel. It's a, I think it's a 2.8-liter baby Duramax diesel. Comes in a 6-speed because of differences in torque curve with the gasoline versus diesel transmission. So, and also choice. I think they just didn't get a whole lot better fuel economy with two extra speeds in the diesel, because diesels inherently run more fuel efficient. I will say this. On the high speed course in the corners, the diesel was slow because it had took time to spool up, and you wanted to get going. You just could feel you wanted to get going. You could left foot brake, so you could hold left foot down on the brake, put your foot on the diesel gas accelerator, keep it revved up, let go of the brake, and then take off. It would be faster. I would just go gasoline. The gasoline was a lot faster on the off-road high speed track. On the off-road, when you're off-roading over the lead and follow, we did through some trails with some rocks, and we did the stair step. The diesel was the way to go because you didn't need to spool up. You were going to put your foot on the accelerator and just climb. And that additional torque, it was 367 foot-pounds of torque, that really helped get over a lot of those climbs. And so it's just something to think in mind. It's going to be an interesting choice for people, depending what you decide to do, depending what you are going to buy the truck for. It really makes a difference on day-to-day driving. Personally, I like the diesel. I like the fuel economy. You're talking 22 miles per gallon highway, 20 miles per gallon combined. That's 2 miles per gallon better than the gasoline in all its circumstances. You do pay for it. It is an expensive upgrade. It's about $4,000 is what we figured out. I did drive an extended cab diesel with the rear seat delete. So all extended this one had the seats. You can get it with the rear seat delete and just make it extended cab. This one had the seats, and was $45,000. So for those who think that $45,000 is a lot for a midsize truck, I would challenge your thinking on that. I've really started coming away from these events, and the more I drive these products, is thinking that they're a completely different segment of trucks. The half ton and midsize, the space between them has just changed so much. It used to be that the S10 was just a smaller Silverado. It's not the case. They look different these days. They drive different. They're different trucks. And so a truck isn't a truck. A pickup is not a pickup. I would challenge your thinking on that. It's at dealers now. They started shipping a couple weeks ago. Go and check them out. take them for a drive, see what you think. I came really impressed. I think that it's got some big advantages over the Tacoma in that it's got the front locker, it's got the diesel option, it's got the multimatic shocks, which are really good, and it's got a very comfortable interior. They put a lot more, should we put a lot more money into this? I don't think they have the same profit margin as, say, Toyota has in their Tacoma TRD Pro, and it shows. It's just a much nicer truck. And the Nissan Frontier Pro 4X, I mean, it's just old. It's just not big enough, or not, actually not big enough, but it's just really old. It doesn't have technology. It's not the same. It's just not a comparable competitor to me. And for those wondering about the Raptor could be a competitor to the Chevy Colorado ZR2. No, I'm not seeing that. And the reason I'm not saying that is because it's such a dramatic size difference. I really do think that the smaller size of the ZR2 just works for a lot of people in off-roading because you don't have to worry about how big the truck is. And I just don't see them as strong competitors. You know, the ZR2 is going to destroy the Raptor and high-speed – Raptor, I'll say that backwards. The Raptor is going to destroy the ZR2 in an off-road race. It's just going to. That's what it's built for. But the ZR2, as an everyday truck, as an off-roading, as they can go hunting in the mountains or something, it's a great truck, and it fits well, fits into trails. It's definitely worthwhile checking out. And like I said, we need to get over this price issue as far as whether or not we think it's good or bad or whatever. I'm telling you, they're different trucks. They're different animals. They are priced accordingly for what they are. It's not comparable to a Silverado. And I will say this about the Silverado. I'm very, very excited to see what Chevy has learned with the Colorado ZR2 that it can apply to future editions of the Chevy Silverado. Because let's face it, the Z71 package is just stickers. It's nothing fantastic about that package at all. If they could build a Chevy Silverado ZR2, oh boy, oh boy, you'd really have a Raptor competitor then. You could finally get to that, to a more comparable. I still don't think anybody's going to build a Raptor to that point. It's a small segment. Yes, the profit margins are big, but it's a smaller segment, and getting all the putting the money into it just isn't in the cards for a lot of manufacturers. So, was very excited to drive it. I've been looking forward to it. It's such a great truck. I can't wait to get a press loan of it because we do these lead and follows. You have to maintain your certain speeds and things. And I found an off-road track about 2 hours from here, and I'm sure there's a couple in Wyoming as well, South Dakota. There's a couple places. And when I get this truck, I will be gone for the day because I'm going to go out and tear up the dirt and have a good time because it is a lot of fun. And that's it for the Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk this week. Thanks for joining us. Thanks as always. Hit the subscribe button. Tell your friends. Make sure you follow us on Facebook on Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. Website is pickuptrucktalk.com. Send me an email. Leave me a review. Tell me I suck. Whatever you want to do. Tim at pickuptrucktalk.com. I do read all the comments. I respond to anything I can. I respond to all the comments on YouTube that I can. So reach out to me. Let me know what you're thinking. Let me know if you have any questions. And we'll see you down the road.